Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest this morning, Julie Zicafus. She's a natural history writer, artist, and NPR commentator. Julie, welcome to the show.
Oh, it's so great to be back. Thank you, Linda.
It's Ann.
Ann! Don't.
That's okay, Julie. Or Janie, or whatever your name is. Last time we talked, it was winter.
Yes.
And you were complaining a lot.
Yeah.
And I made fun of you.
Yeah, you did. And I'm back.
No fear. So you're dug out.
Yes.
The snow went away, and now it's gardening time.
Well, you know, it actually rained. It's such an event because the spring started off fabulously, and we had frogs in every puddle. It was so exciting, and it was just everything was alive and squirming with tadpoles, and then it stopped. And everything dried up just like tinder, and there were no burning, you know, regulations in force in our area.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and since I love to burn things, that was upsetting. I really.
For the pyros among us.
It's kind of a therapy for me. You know, nobody says anything when you do it. You can burn whatever you want, but I just burn newspaper, and because I always have so many critters around, there's always lots of icky newspapers.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So anyway, we didn't. You know, I burned with great care, and the tadpoles all died, and then finally, we got a quarter of an inch of rain last night and this morning, and I'm hoping for 2 more inches, you know.
Yeah, it seems like it always rains over the weekend, but yeah, we needed it, and we needed it here as well. But there was so much snow over the winter, I felt like the ground really held a lot more moisture.
It did, and the water table is high. Our little shallow well is pretty high, and, you know, I think the water table is still fairly up there, but, you know, the water that I needed for, like, my lettuce didn't even come up, which has never happened to me.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I just kind of, like, had it. I'm going to replant, you know, as soon as the soil is moist through.
So what are you planting this year?
Well, just the sugar snap peas are finally up. They're very slow because it's just been too dry, but they're finally all up. And I'm going to grow, I think I'll grow some patty pan squash this year, which is just a squash that I adore. It's the little one that looks kind of like a flying saucer with scalloped edges.
Yeah.
Love that stuff. And I think I might grow a little eggplant this year. I enjoy that. But mostly it's peas and tomatoes and snap beans.
Do you can?
You know, I used to, but then I had kids and, you know, started doing all that. I basically chase every shiny thing that comes by, so it's very hard for me to buckle down for an entire day in the kitchen and can, or an entire week, or however long it takes. I just remember it being excruciating, so no, I don't can anymore.
And it's also the hottest time of the year.
It is, and basically you're on your feet from dawn to dark, and then you have these jars that, you know, I don't know.
Well, and then my kid complains about the smell of vinegar.
Oh, the smell of vinegar.
Yeah,
and you have to wash the jars. And, you know, I should be canning, but we just eat. What we do basically is gorge while it's fresh. We wouldn't make very good hunter-gatherers, you know.
What do you think about the whole locavore movement?
I love it. I'm a total locavore. I mean, I will seek out the sort of the most unlikely looking grocery stores will often have the local stuff. And I was thrilled to find local organic eggs in a rather large discount supermarket around here. So I grabbed those, and I kind of know where to go for it. Of course, the farmer's market is wonderful, but it's so hard for me to get out between 9 and 12 on a Saturday morning.
I hear you on that one.
It's the only time I have with my kids and husband. That's it, you know. And so it's really hard for me to say, okay, going in to shop. But I do go to we have a fabulous farmer's market in Marietta. And my mother-in-law, Elsa Thompson, actually helped start it years ago. She used to drive around and get eggs from local farmers and bring them to the farmer's market for them.
So where you're at, that's where your husband's from?
Well, he was born in Pella, Iowa, and stayed there until third grade. And then his whole family moved here to Marietta. And so he was raised here, yeah.
You're listening to Julie Zicafus, the natural history writer, artist, and NPR commentator. If you have a question or comment for Julie, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're going to talk about it later, so I'll just ask listeners if you've seen any special bird sightings. Julie, I was reading your blog, and I was loving it. You're talking about how horrible it would be to be married to somebody that doesn't like to bird with you.
Oh, imagine that. I mean, I try to. You know, there are people who like the woman goes birding and the guy goes and plays golf, you know.
Yeah.
And or like he'll go birding and she'll go find the nearest outlet or something like that. And I think that's probably more common than having somebody who gets just as excited about the black-throated green warbler singing in the ash tree as you do. And that is something I really treasure about Bill, my husband, who is, after all, editor of Birdwatcher's Digest. So he better care.
Exactly. So when you guys go out together, how long do you stay? You said you went out for the first time in the spring recently.
Mm-hmm. Well, what we do is before he goes to work, we usually climb up to the tower, which is on top of our house. And we stand up in there for an hour or so, you know, sort of in between kid buses and, you know, breakfast and all the stuff that we have to do in the morning. We'll sneak up there and just kind of see as many birds as we can. We keep, and just as a sort of a little game, we'll keep a list of how many birds we can see on a given morning. And that gives us actually a really good picture of how migration is progressing.
How is it? What's going on right now? What should we be looking for?
It's a very, very weird migration. It's things are very late. Like, my hummingbirds almost invariably arrive on the 17th of April, and I have seen nary a one. My friend in the Cincinnati area says exactly the same thing. Hers come in on the 17th, and she hasn't had one yet. And there are many things that were very, very late. Louisiana water thrush is usually here by 10th of April or so, and they didn't show up until about the 24th here.
It's strange because it's been so warm. It can't be the cold that's keeping them away.
Right, right. I have no idea what's going on, but every spring is a little bit different, you know. Sometimes I think, well, the hummingbirds are not here because there are no flowers. Well, there's just flowers everywhere and no birds. So, and there's plenty of insects around that I can see. Mm-hmm. The leaves are out. The birds should be here. But they just haven't gotten in yet.
Are there people that birders check with, like farther south or something like that, that you go, hey, did the hummingbirds show up there yet?
Yeah, there's actually kind of a neat website called Bad Birds Migration Radar. I think they spell it BADBIRDZ.
Mm-hmm.
And they have, like, migration maps of the birds coming up. So sort of like little dots on the map that show you where the birds are at any given time. And there's also a website that tracks the hummingbird movements north, and that's pretty easy to find by Googling. And so you can check your map every day and see, oh, they're in Huntersville, North Carolina. They must be, they'll be here in 8 hours or whatever. So, so it's really actually very, very cool.
Let's take a couple calls. First of all, Tom, you're on the air. You want to talk about apple trees. Hi, Tom.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
I've got I have 6 apple trees, all different varieties. I've got the New York red ones. I have Golden Delicious and Grannies. And I have 2 pear trees. One pear tree I managed to keep cut down low, but I have one that, oh my gosh, about 3 stories tall. I was wondering if I can cut that back without killing it.
Boy. you've asked the wrong person. I don't know about cutting back pear trees. I really don't know much. I'll tell you why I don't know much, because when we moved onto our place in 1992, there was an orchard here, and somehow we decided we would prune it, and so we pruned all the trees. And that the fall we were married in 1993, we had a bumper crop of apples like you've never seen. It was fabulous. Well, come to find out that was the apple saying, we're dying now. Thank you for chopping our heads off. And all the trees died. So, like, for you to call me up and ask me how to handle a fruit tree is not a good idea.
Sorry about that, Tom.
I had a plum tree, and I cut that back, in the fall. And then come spring, I had, like you said, a bumper crop of plums.
And then what?
And then all the leaves fell off and it died.
Wow.
It sounds like you're following right in my footsteps.
Okay.
My wife did not like me.
My wife did not like me at that time.
Well, Tom, you know what? Deborah Kanapke's going to be on in a few weeks, so check that out. She'll know.
All right. I just want to say one other thing. We are avid gardeners. We plant just about everything we can. We do our own grape jelly, our own cherry jelly and jam.
Wow.
We make our own salsa, hot salsa out of our peppers. We make a salsa crude.
Golly.
Some people say all they use is a tablespoon to make a dip, because if they try and eat it raw, they they lose about 5 pounds in sweat.
Well, enjoy the season, Tom.
Oh, this is our favorite time of the year.
Okay.
And we got our canning down to almost industrial now.
Go for it.
Okay.
Take care. Cut back that pear tree.
Bye. Love your program. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Tom. Is this good time for me to brag about my cherry pies?
Do it.
We lived with this cherry tree in our backyard for like 2 or 3 years, and my husband kept threatening to chop it down because it was so old and scraggly looking, but it was kind of pretty in a pathetic old way.
Right.
So I wanted him to keep it, and he did. And then 1 year I noticed the birds were all over, and I'm like, wait a minute, I always thought it was kind of like an ornamental cherry.
Right.
And if you knew how small my backyard was, you'd be appalled.
Uh-huh.
And the birds were getting at it, and finally I realized I grabbed and pulled one of those cherries down, and I tasted it, and lo and behold, it's a sour cherry, baking cherry.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, and every year I get more and more pies off of it because now we're trimming it and everything, you know.
Yeah.
I think it's got to be dead. I mean, you just look at it. It looks so old. The trunk almost looks hollow,
mm-hmm.
Just like Chet was climbing in the other day.
Right.
Which I want to talk about Chet the dog. But, yeah, every year, more pies.
I'm mad at my friend Margaret because she moved from the house that had the sour cherry pie tree in the backyard. And she would bring over these great big Ziploc bags of slightly cooked cherries and just gift them to me. And so they went into, oh, my gosh, a sour cherry cobbler, please. So
oh, my
good.
God. Well, yeah. I told my husband, I said, I want to have a sour cherry pie party. And he said, no way. We're going to take a short break. And when we return, we'll be talking again with Julie Zickafoos, the natural history writer, the wonderful artist and NPR commentator. If you want to give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back on All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
President Obama says Iran must pay a price if it continues to defy the international community on nuclear enrichment.
Words have to mean something. There have to be some consequences.
That after his Secretary of Defense asked what happens if they go ahead and build a nuclear weapon. I'm Neil Conan, Ted Koppel, and Zbigniew Brzezinski join us. Options on Iran. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
And Talk of the Nation begins this afternoon at 2 o'clock right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. 50 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:19 this morning. Morning rain is very likely and then a 50% chance of rain throughout the afternoon. Steady temperatures right in the mid-50s today. A slight chance of rain tonight and mostly cloudy, a low of 40 degrees. Sunny tomorrow and a high of 56.
Support for WOSU comes from the estate of Donald R. Glancy, whose life was enriched by public radio and television, and whose bequest seeks to encourage others to discover WOSU Public Media.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Julie Zickafoos, the natural history writer, artist, and NPR commentator. And Julie, I'm looking at your book, Letters from Eden, A Year at Home in the Woods.
Yes.
And on page 77, there is the coolest picture of a couple of starlings.
Oh, yeah.
And I never knew they were so colorful.
Yeah, well, you know, I can paint them any way I want.
Yeah.
And so I did go a little crazy there. But they are, you know, you get a starling in good light. And especially this time of year, one of my favorite things to look for is to get the binoculars on them and check out how the mandible goes from blackish gray in winter to this beautiful corn yellow. And then at the base of the mandible is this turquoise spot of skin that is well worth checking out. You know, just standing under a starling that's singing in the spring sunshine with a pair of binoculars is a real revelation because you listen to all of the things they imitate, car alarms and honking horns. And I even had a starling in my yard imitate my son's voice, called, Mommy, Mommy. And it was just unbelievable.
You know what? I think a starling was imitating me whistling for my dog this morning.
Oh, I completely believe that.
Could that have possibly be? Because after I was whistling for her, all of a sudden this bird started like hooting out there, same pitch, everything.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Well, let's not forget that the famous talking mynah bird is actually a starling. It's an Indian starling. And the sternellids in general, you know, the starlings and minos are very, very gifted at mimicry, and they can do, you know, they can do the crazy sounds. They can do about anything, dripping water, or they're really talented, and they also have a great sense of humor as birds. Having raised one, I can attest to that.
614-292-8513, and Ralph is on the air. You want to talk about?
Hi, Julie. Ralph Ramey here.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm great.
If they'd only imported that superb starling from Kenya instead of the ugly black one.
You know, there's a little problem with the whole tropical thing. The superb starling would have been so unhappy in a snowy Ohio winter.
I know it would have.
But I agree.
Like
with that.
You.
That is a bird and a half. The superb starling is glossy purple on the back, glossy steel blue on the breast, and brilliant egg yolk orange on the underside with startling orange eyes. Oh, my gosh.
I've got photographs of it. I've seen it many times in Kenya.
Yes.
Hey, I really enjoyed the Kura this year Bird Watchers Digest, especially your article on hummingbirds.
Thanks.
And every time I read your articles, I learn something new in spite of my 88 years or whatever it is.
Well, that's lovely to hear. I really like that piece, actually. I wrote an article called Hummingbird Hospital, and it's about having taken in an injured hummingbird who had been trapped in a warehouse down in Marietta. And the man who called me said she had gotten into the warehouse at about 11 at night, and he called me around noon the next day. And he'd been unable to get the bird to drink any nectar. He said he had some nectar there he was offering her. So I raced into town. I've been, you know, this time of year I have to get very used to dropping whatever I'm doing and racing off, sort of the bird ambulance. And I raced into town, and he had it in a little couple little dishes sort of taped together, and he opened it up, and there she was lying on her side, curled into a sort of a C shape, just about dead. And I took the nectar that he had, which was that commercial preparation with the red dye in it.
Right.
And I kind of cringed, and I stuck her bill into the tube, and I waited until she started struggling, and when she did struggle, some drops went in, and she drank this big draft of it. Well, then I got her home, and I started, you know, I put her in housing and everything, and I gave her the good colorless solution that I use, which is full of protein and extra stuff for hummingbirds. 24 hours later, that hummingbird was still excreting bright red dye.
I believe it.
It was astonishing and quite alarming. And that was from two small feedings of this commercial hummingbird food preparation. So needless to say, I advocate never using artificial coloring in hummingbird food.
Right.
And if you must buy a commercial preparation because you just like the convenience, buy one that is colored only with beet.
I haven't seen that.
Well, yeah, the same manufacturer that makes the really sort of nasty stuff with red dye number 40 also makes one that's colorless and also makes one that is colored with beet juice. So if you read the labels and avoid those with the carcinogenic red dye in them, I think your hummingbirds will be a lot better off.
Well, it's amazing how quickly those birds will recover. I've pulled, you know, paper up on the ground that's hit a window.
Mm-hmm.
And you get a little sugar in them.
Yeah. It's astonishing. And a lot of people don't know to do that. But when you find a hummingbird incapacitated, the first thing to do is to mix up a little hummingbird solution, which
sure.
is one part of
four
sugar and four parts of water, and put it in a little eyedropper and insert the hummingbird's bill into the eyedropper. Mm-hmm. And if it refuses to feed at first, when it starts to struggle, then it will get some food. And then you'll see the little tongue lash. And they suck it up, and they're ready to go.
It's amazing. You think you're a miracle worker.
I know. that's what keeps me in bird rehab. It's those little miracles that happen.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
See, hey, the whole issue, this, you can tell, Bill, the whole issue is one of the best that you've had. I really enjoyed every article.
Oh, you're a doll. Thank you so much.
Not rather from cover to cover.
Coming from a long-term subscriber, that means a ton to us. Thank you.
That's, of course, Ralph Ramey, author of 50 Hikes in Ohio.
You got that right.
All righty. Just wanted to get that in there. Thanks for calling, Ralph.
Yeah, it's good to talk to you, Julie.
Thanks, Ralph, and I'll
keep up the good
regards.
Work. I look for your articles and your art. I love your art.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Julie, one of your big blogs postings this spring was about bats,
mm-hmm.
and you said you wanted to talk about bats, and when I went and looked up that posting, I read the whole thing, and what a story. Why don't you tell us about that? And by the way, I've never seen bats look so dang cute
as
they did in those photographs.
Yeah, well, I had kind of an interesting thing happened to me this winter. In late winter, my mother-in-law in town, who has a, I believe she has a roost in the attic of their old home in Marietta, which a lot of the old homes in Marietta do, has a roost of big brown bats. And this is not cause for alarm, but big brown bats are very, very good at finding their way into the heated, inhabited spaces of houses, and nobody really knows why or how they do it. We think they might have come down along the chimney lining. And a big brown bat showed up in her living room, flying around, and it was clearly a situation where you couldn't just chase the bat outside because there was snow all over the ground. And protocol for a bat that's found in a heated space in the winter is to take it into captivity and feed it all winter, because once it's gotten warmed up and has been flying around for a few days, it's used up the energy reserves that it would need to get through the rest of the winter in a hibernatory state. So I raced into town and fed the bat some mealworms off the end of a tweezers and brought it home and promptly fell in love. And in order to be able to harbor bats, you have to have your rabies vector species certification, and luckily I had that. That is a course that you have to take in order to know how to handle a potentially rabies-carrying species, and that includes foxes, raccoons, bats, skunks, and even feral cats, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
So I had that certification, and so I kept the bat in my studio, and I was astonished at how responsive, intelligent, and just downright endearing this little creature was, and I named her Dee Dee. And it wasn't another 2 weeks, but I got another call from my mother-in-law, and the same living room had another bat in it, and that was a male. And I went in to get that one. And I brought them in and put them in the tank with Dee Dee, hoping that they'd get along. And by that evening, they were making more bats. So they got along really well. And that in itself was really cute. I have to tell you, bat love is very endearing. So I had these two little bats, and that was wonderful. And my kids were thrilled to pieces with them. And my son, who is 8, was helping me feed them. Now, I have to say that I was completely... never handled them without gloves, and always used a tweezers to feed them. There was, you know, we never contacted them directly. But I would give Daryl never learned to self-feed out of a dish, so I would be hand-feeding Daryl. And I would give him his water out of a dropper, and at one point, Daryl spluttered, as bats often do when you're giving them water, and a drop landed on Liam's cheek. And I started thinking about that. And I started thinking about bat saliva, and I had already been reading up a great deal on rabies, and I freaked out. And I decided that it was time to look into protecting us just in case. Although these bats had absolutely no visible signs of illness, I realized that the potential cost of having a droplet of bat spit land on my son's lip was unacceptable. So it was a very, very, very difficult process to go through to realize that I had to have this dear bat, Daryl, tested for rabies in order to know that my son was going to be okay. So you don't, when you test a bat for rabies, you have to have it euthanized, and they have to look at its brain tissue. So Daryl had to die so that my son would be absolutely safe. And as someone who loves wildlife and who was trying to do the right thing, to have done a succession of exactly the wrong things was very, very difficult. So that was the sad story. I then took Dee Dee up to the Ohio Wildlife Center, where she is in flight conditioning right now, and I hope she's going to be releasable this spring. And we'll take her back to the exact place where she was found, not inside the house this time, but we'll hang her on a tree next to the house. Bats can live as long as 30 years and in the wild, and they know very well where they are on the planet, and they know just what crack to crawl into to get into their roost. So I'm very much hoping to be able to release Dee Dee, who is undoubtedly pregnant, so she can go to a maternity roost and deliver her babies in the wild this spring.
I was going to ask if she's with child.
Almost undoubtedly. X-rays taken of big brown bats at the roosts in Indiana showed that 90% of the females had been impregnated by fall and were carrying babies by spring. And bats have a very interesting ability to delay implantation. They will mate in October in these sort of bat orgies, and then they will store the sperm all winter, and they don't implant until about now, and then they give birth in May.
Now, you were getting a round of shots.
Yeah, yeah.
What was that all about?
Well, what finally settled out of all this is that anybody who deals with rabies vector species really ought to have rabies prophylactic shots as opposed to post-exposure shots. The reason I had Daryl tested was the post-exposure shots are extremely expensive and can be painful, mm-hmm. and I didn't want to put my son and me through that if the bat tested negative for rabies, which he did. Daryl was rabies-free. So there was never actually a danger, but there was a possible danger that, you know, had he been infected with rabies and a tiny droplet of spit had gotten on my son's mucous membrane or perhaps in his eye, that could have constituted a rabies exposure, which is why we had to have the bat tested. But I decided to go ahead and get the pre-exposure shots because I will doubtless be dealing with more bats, and, you know, I pick up injured critters all the time, and I try to help where I can. So it only makes sense for me to be protected, as are all veterinarians.
You know? What about Liam and
what's going to happen here is that if Liam wants to help feed bats, I'm going to get him a welder's mask and have him wear gloves and just, you know, absolutely, you know, eliminate the chance that he could come into contact with any saliva or anything like that.
You know, a lot of times when I've looked at bats, photographs of bats, it's always sort of like for me looking at an ultrasound of a human baby. I just not very good at figuring out where their head is and where their, you know, their feet are. I've never been.
Right.
I still stare at my own kid's ultrasound. I don't get it. Uh-huh. But the photographs you took, I'd recommend anybody go check out your website and your blog and look at those because they really are cute as a kitten.
Big brown bats are exceptionally appealing animals, and you can find those photographs at juliezickafoos.blogspot.com. And I suppose we ought to spell the name, don't you think?
Yeah, ZICKEFOOSE.
Mm-hmm.
JULIE.
Yeah.
Julie Zickafoos. And of course, we'll post that on our website at wosu.org/allsides so you don't have to worry about it.
You know, the absolute key to bat photography, and I had a chance, I went in a bat cave in Oklahoma a couple weeks ago, and the absolute key to bat photography is to get down your camera lens right in their face so that you can, you know, you're not photographing them from above where they kind of look like a little blob. But if you can get into those little faces, they have the most incredible faces mm-hmm. with bright little eyes and great big ears that swivel around. And I have to say, they just captured my heart. And I really hope to work with bats again, even with the grief and the anguish that you know, mm-hmm. having those bats cause me. I only want to keep working with them. They're so worth it. And, you know, bats are right now under siege from probably the greatest wildlife epizootic disease of all time, and that's white nose disease, which is decimating bat populations all through the Northeast, and it's moving west.
Is that like a mold?
Well, they're not actually sure what the mechanism is. They don't know whether the fungus that grows on the bats' noses is the causative agent or whether it's just something that comes after they've gotten really sick. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So they're not really sure what the function is, but they are thinking that it's a fungal disease, and it causes the bats to behave strangely. They'll come out in the dead of winter and fly around in the snow until they perish.
Is it all different kinds of bats?
Well, it's hardest on the little brown bat mm-hmm. because the fungus thrives in cold, moist conditions. And little brown bats tend to choose sort of danker caves and wet places to roost. But it seems to be affecting little brown, big brown, and the endangered Indiana bat as well. And I'm not absolutely sure of the range of bat species that it affects, but it is frightening.
Bats are good things. I've known that for a long time. They eat mosquitoes.
They eat mosquitoes. They eat flying insects at night. They eat tremendous numbers of flying mosquitoes and other insects. And they eat a lot of moths and, you know, gypsy moths and things like that. So So they're essential, and they're also pollinators for a lot of flowers. A lot of people don't know that.
I didn't know that.
Yes, and they also disperse tree fruits. And in the tropics is where bats really sort of blossom into these incredible pollinating and seed dispersal mechanisms where they, you know, they're species of trees that completely depend on bats for pollination and dispersal. And there's a lot of that going on in North America as well. And most of our bats are insectivorous. In North America,
okay,
for obvious reasons, and many of them are migratory because, of course, you know, the insects dry up in the winter, and a lot of them hibernate through that period when there are no insects.
I caught a bat one time.
Did you?
In a ice bucket in a hotel room.
Oh,
in
my.
Minnesota.
Hopefully it was in the summer.
Minneapolis, yeah, it was.
Good for you. Like, did you put it outside?
I don't know. I don't remember what happened because I was with my dad and my brother, and I went down to my dad. He was at the front desk of the hotel, and I said, "Dad, there's a bat in the ice bucket." And he's like, "Ah, ha, 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 ha." I'm like, "No, really, there's a bat in the ice bucket up in the room."
Oh, little Annie.
And I, you know, there she goes, Anna Banana. And I said, "No, really." And he's like, he kept laughing. But then the guy behind the desk took me seriously.
Oh, yeah, I bet he did.
And they had it up there. And I don't know whatever happened to that bat. But
I hope they let it go.
I do, too. Yeah. I let spiders go. So
I do, too.
When we return with Julie Zicafus, we will take a call or two. And then we'll talk about some other stuff. 614-292-8513. Or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Get more radio. The WOSU Spring Membership Drive begins soon. And if we raise $20,000 before it begins, we'll take one day off the drive. Get more programming and less pledging when you make your fast and easy gift to WOSU. Help us reach our $175,000 goal and get more of the radio you love to listen to by making your contribution now. Visit WOSU.org/pledgefree to make your pledge.
You're listening to WOSU 820 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Sides will be here. We'll hear about the crisis of an American city, Detroit, Michigan, and the issues of downsizing, urban planning, neighborhood, and community concerns. That discussion begins at 11 right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. And you can hear more from WOSU anytime at WOSU.org. Listen to All Sides with Ann Fisher whenever you want with the online archive. Podcast new and archived shows from all the guests and topics. Podcast All Sides at WOSU.org/allsides. And it's 50 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:39. Morning rain today and then a 50% chance of rain this afternoon and steady temperatures right around 50 degrees. Clouds tonight and a low of 40. Sunshine for Tuesday and a high of 56. And looking ahead to Wednesday, sunny and a high of 60. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest today, Julie Zicafus, the natural history writer, artist, and NPR commentator. Let's take a call, 614-292-8513. And Adam, you're on the air with Julie Zicafus.
Good morning.
Morning.
Hey, I had a question. I wanted to see if your guest could comment on bald eagles repopulating southern and southeastern Ohio. I live in Athens, and I'm actually just in Columbus working here right now. But the other day, I was taking a stroll down the Hocking, and as clear as day, right above me, I saw a big old bald eagle fishing the Hocking River.
Yeah.
That's the only one I've seen. I took a hike up here. I believe it was called High Banks.
Yeah, there's a bald eagle nest at High Banks now.
Yeah, I saw a pair fishing the river there.
That's something.
I don't see them very often down my way in southeast Ohio, and
right.
I just wondered if you could comment on their status.
Well, I would love to have more up-to-date information. I could probably quickly Google that for you, but I know that they're around, and the nests are popping up everywhere. There was actually an attempted nest right at the landing of Blennerhassett Park in Parkersburg. About 4 years ago, that was just crazy, you know. It was like, what? But they are popping up everywhere, and I am so excited about this because, you know, mm-hmm. like when you're up in Lake Country, Ohio, up around Lake Erie, bald eagles are a common sight.
Right.
They are circling overhead all the time, and there are nests all over the place. And they're just spreading into our part of the state. And basically, they're going to show up wherever there's water and fish.
They're not as shy as we once thought.
Well, that's what's so neat. We're learning a lot more about what this bird is capable of as there are more to observe.
Mm-hmm.
As when you and I grew up, and you probably thought you'd never actually see one.
They were on a coin. That
they
was as close as it was going to get.
They were on a flag. And I remember we'd go down into Tidewater, Virginia, and I'd maybe see one circling high overhead, and it was as if my world just rang. And now when I go back to Richmond, Virginia, they're nesting right inside of the James River Bridge. They're all over the place. And bald eagles are much more adaptable and much less spooky than we've always thought.
Mm-hmm.
You know how it's like, well, if they're nesting in that tree, there has to be a mile berth around it. Nobody goes near
right.
it. Well, not actually the case, as shown by the birds that attempted to nest on a busy boat landing in Parkersburg. The other cool thing is that they are extremely adaptable in their diets. And we had a subscriber to Birdwatchers Digest write in to tell us that she had just made, this was an Alaska subscriber, where there are a lot of bald eagles, always have been. She had just made a big pan of lasagna and had set it out on her deck railing to cool. And she looked out to see an adult bald eagle carrying talons full of lasagna away from her deck with the noodles, like, dropping from its feet as it labored off with the food. So they don't just eat live fish. You know, they will eat carrion. They will frequent dumps. They are, you know, as Ben Franklin said, a bird of questionable moral character.
I wondered if I could ask two quick questions if
sure,
I was still
sure.
on it. One, if you find an eagle feather on the ground, some people tell me that it's illegal to take that. Is that the case?
Yes, they are a protected species, and eagles have sort of special protections on them. It's actually illegal to possess any feather of any non-game migratory bird in the U.S. or any non-game
really?
Bird. Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of people don't know that, but I have a friend who was walking down a forest trail in Connecticut and stuck a pileated woodpecker wing feather in his hat, and there was a wildlife agent who happened to be in the parking lot of the park where he was, and he got busted and fined.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, why is that? Why if
well,
the leaf, I mean, if the wing or the feather has fallen on the ground.
Right, right. Eagles are a big part of the reason why that's illegal, because you know, the eagle feathers are very important in Native American ceremony.
Okay.
And they make eagle wing fans and all kinds of stuff like that. And see, if everybody just shot eagles or shot birds just to get their feathers and to make things out of them, we'd have a very sorry state. So the easiest thing was to just put a blanket ban on possessing the feathers of any birds. And then because eagle feathers are so highly prized, to put special fines on those. So it's a very, very bad idea to possess an eagle feather. That is something that most wildlife officers would recognize instantly from its sheer size. And you just don't want to stick that on the dashboard of your car.
Wow.
You just don't want to do that. And, you know, the good reason is that it's to protect the bird.
Sure, right.
And you can say that you got it from a bird that had naturally shed it or you found it on the ground, but how do you know?
Right.
And with eagles, that's a particular problem. Now, a lot of Native Americans have special permits to collect a certain number of eagles to use their feathers. And there's a new organization that actually collects feathers from road-killed and accidentally shot eagles, poisoned eagles, and distributes them to Native American tribes so that the pressure will be taken off the wild populations.
Mm. Well, last thing real quick, as much as you're into birds, I'm curious if you know a guy named Bill Perini. He teaches over at Hocking College.
I haven't had the pleasure.
No, he's a great guy. He's, as far as I know, he does a lot of photography work with birds. He was my ornithology teacher years ago when I was there. It got me into it.
Cool.
And you're in Marietta, right? So
yeah, well, I'm north of Marietta.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
Well, I just thought perhaps, I know he gets around a good bit down around, you know, in the Athens County area.
Nice.
But, well, thanks for the show. Thanks for the show. Have a good day.
Thanks,
Adam.
Bye.
That's really interesting about the feathers. I didn't know that.
A lot of people don't know that. And, you know, they think, oh, there's a pretty cardinal feather. I'm going to, you know, put it in my hat. But it's probably a bad idea. I possess actually special permits to possess rehab and salvaged birds. So I can, it's not like I flaunt it or anything, but I can have specimens on my possession and not get busted for it.
Do you have dog hair in your house?
I have little tiny black dog hairs that look like eyelashes. Yeah, they're pretty much on everything.
No, my dog doesn't ever shed anything, and it shows. She looks like a big white or dirty white sheep.
What is she?
She's a Labradoodle. A third generation one, though. She's got heavy-duty hair.
Yeah.
Because my son's seriously allergic to dogs, so we had to get one.
Yes. How has she worked out?
I worship the ground she walks
Yay.
On.
That's so wonderful to hear. That seemed like a very inspired mix of dogs to me.
Yeah, she's a very, very smart. Mm-hmm. And you can play hot and cold with her when she'll lose a tennis ball, and you can go... No, no, no. When she's looking for it, she'll start looking around. And good, good, good.
Wonderful.
So, how about Chet, though? Chet goes in hollow trees.
Yeah, well, he's my woods companion, and he's a Boston Terrier, one of the larger 25-pounders, and he is a sturdy little guy. And we, I sort of hike for a living, and he goes with me whenever I go and is a terrific snorter-outer of chipmunks and squirrels and rabbits and things like that. So we have a great deal of fun in the woods. I have the great luxury of being able to walk through woods where I don't have to have him on a lead. So I get mm-hmm. to watch him do his doggy things, and it's really fun.
You at the end of the last posting on him, you said something so sweet. You said, what did you say?
I had a picture of myself with his head resting on my arm. And he falls asleep that way on my lap, and he'll kind of drape his head over my arm. And I said, he's not heavy. He's my heartbeat.
Oh, it's so sweet. I love that.
I love that, too.
Do you spend a lot of time on Facebook now?
Too much. Yeah.
What's that like for you? Because you're kind of an outdoorsy sort of a person.
Well, it's kind of like crack, actually. I have to be careful.
I shouldn't laugh like I actually know what you're talking about, but yeah. Okay.
Well, here's the crack part. I live in the middle of 80 acres. I can't see any houses from my house, right? So all of a sudden I have this, like, community of little people in my computer.
Yeah.
And they're all my buddies, and one's in Oklahoma. Two of them are in Oklahoma, and some are in California. And these are people I may not have been able to talk to for years.
Mm-hmm.
And there they all are, just nattering away 24 hours a day. So I literally have to take a hit every now and then and then stop.
Yeah.
But I use it as kind of a reward, like if I finish something, then I'll go see what everybody's up to.
You must have them from all over the place because you travel so much.
I do. And, I'm kind of a Facebook slut. I'll friend anybody.
How many friends do you have?
900.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty scary. And, it doesn't hurt to friend people.
No.
The only thing that happens is that, like, then you can't even wade through the updates.
Right.
You can't even think about doing that. So, I found that sort of in the cyber world, I'm sort of a content provider. I'm not really a content taker-inner. So what I do is I just get a bang out of writing the 30-word update or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And then seeing what people say. But it's like I don't find myself really, reading everybody else's updates all that much. I just kind of, have this party on my page all the time.
Yeah, they have to tag me, it's hard for me to get to it.
That's right.
As well.
Yeah.
So I get personal.
Kind of the same way about blogging. It's nothing personal. It's just, I really like putting out a well-crafted blog post, but I don't feel like I have the time to give to reading 30 blogs.
Mm-hmm.
So I just kind of create it, and then I just kind of lay it out there, and that's what I do. And I think people understand that because I gotta keep fixing busted birds and things like that. I can't be online 24 hours a day.
Did you ever notice how many people make friends in the morning?
I haven't.
Every morning starts out with a new flock of friends of people
goodness.
Saying so and so is now friends with blah 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 and blah mm-hmm. blah blah blah.
Mm-hmm.
You're working on a book still, aren't you?
Well, yeah, I'm supposed to. I wish my editor was
cackling
right now. Yeah, I am. I actually am. And the problem is I'm kind of in the middle of crazy spring bird festival time. I'm heading down on Thursday with the kids and the dog and the husband to the New River Birding and Nature Festival in Fayetteville, West Virginia. This is a festival that I did the first keynote, I think, 9 years ago, and I'm still doing them. And, you know, they didn't get sick of me. And it puts a speaker in kind of a tough position because you got to change your talk every year, you know, because you get the same people coming. But it's really, really, really fun. And what's crazy is that it's kind of like the flesh the cyber people are turned into flesh there, because the whole blogging and Facebook community is drawing a great number of people to these birding festivals,
uh-huh,
where they get to meet in the flesh for the first time. I have a blogger sitting at the table downstairs who I knew I would adore and invited out here. Her name is Mer Brewster. She flew from Oregon to be here and to attend this festival to meet a bunch of other people that she knew she would adore but had never laid eyes on.
Uh-huh.
So that's where it really gets interesting.
Right.
When you get to actually give a hug to a person that you've been, you know, communicating with over the internet for 2 years.
You know, I met a guy at an event a month ago or so, and he introduced himself to me, and we're talking, and I said, you know, do we know each other?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he said, no. And I go, you're on my Facebook. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That was a weird kind of an interesting feeling. Did you do anything special for Earth Day?
For Earth Day, I pulled a 20 by 30 foot patch of garlic mustard, which is a horrible invasive exotic that is taking over Washington County as I speak.
Mm-hmm.
It's coming into seed, flower. It's finishing flowering, and it's coming into seed, as all mustards do very early. And the thing I really hate about garlic mustard is that it prefers moist, rich soil.
Yep.
Just like trilliums and wild geraniums and Jacob's ladder.
Yep.
And blue-eyed Mary. So, and I actually pulled a whole passel of it yesterday along Newell's Run, which is my favorite wildflower place in Washington County. And I was wading through ankle-deep blue-eyed Mary, which is a rare wildflower that only grows in certain places, pulling this damn mustard. I just loathe it.
Yeah, but even when you try to pull it, it's, you know, it doesn't come up. I mean, it comes out, but
yeah,
it's deceiving.
Well, I know. And the thing is that you may get the whole plant and you may get the whole root and finish off that plant, but the seed bed that it lays every year is just stunning. You could probably pull it every year for 10 years before you'd ever get all of them. But it's worth doing. I have a zero tolerance policy. If I'm around and there's a garlic mustard plant, I'm pulling it.
I've got them all over the place. And you're right about the wild geranium. You're right about where they like to grow. That's for sure, because they go right. I have to clear them out from around the wild geranium.
Yeah.
Every year.
That's what I hate about them. They selectively overtake the best soil.
Yeah.
Even though they could grow anywhere. So I have a personal vendetta. I understand you can eat the stuff, but I hate it too much to put it in my mouth.
Yeah, what do you mean, eat like the flowers?
They put the leaves on sandwiches and stuff.
Well, that's weird.
But I think that if everybody in the world ate 10 pounds of garlic mustard, it still wouldn't make a dent.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a horrible, horrible thing. Who brought that over anyways?
I'd love to know. It's one of those Eurasian exotics that's just, you know, it just seems like every year there's more of them.
We have an email from Meg. She says, I heard that if you pull out poison ivy, that it is worse than just killing it another way. It is if you do it with your bare hands, but is that true?
Worse than just killing it another way.
Like, you mean, I guess, Meg, I guess I'm wondering if she means with herbicide.
Boy, I don't know. Worse in terms of maybe making it propagate or something?
Yeah.
I have no idea. I mean, I pulled up some poison ivy with the garlic mustard. I was so pleased to find a big wad of poison ivy leaves in my hand.
You had gloves on, I hope.
No. Why would I have gloves on? But actually, I came home and put gloves in my car because I knew that, you know, I was going to be pulling more garlic mustard. Didn't get the poison ivy so far. I went home and put bleach all over my hands. I think it helped.
I'm very susceptible to poison ivy.
Oh, me too.
There was one day, I don't know if it was you or somebody else, we ended up doing like half the show on poison ivy.
Oh.
I don't think it was you. It was like a gardening person. And everyone was calling in with their poison ivy cures.
It's nasty stuff.
Yeah.
It's the bane of my existence. Mm-hmm. And I get it. Well, you know, I get it from the dog, too.
I hadn't thought about that.
When you get a bad case of poison ivy in early, early spring, it's probably because your dog has gone romping through the emerging leaves and then brought it in on his coat. That's what happens to me. I get it on my face and on my forearms every spring. And that's from hugging Chet Baker, that little worthless dog.
The light of your life.
The light of my life, my heartbeat, that worthless taxi. Kathy.
Okay, we've got another email. You'd like to email? We've got about 2 minutes left with Julie Zickafoos from a listener. About 10 years ago, I was vacationing just south of Neversink Reservoir in the Catskills of New York. About 20 feet above my head, an osprey was chasing an eagle. Both seemed to be screaming, or whatever you call it. I later read that ospreys don't like it when the eagles, that are increasing in number, invade the osprey's waterfront habitat because the eagles will then compete for the fish. At any rate, the eagle is the national emblem, but the osprey doesn't know that and certainly isn't afraid of eagles.
Well, ospreys hate eagles for a very good reason. The eagles will wait until an osprey does all the hard work of doing the plunge dive and get the fish, and then the eagle will harass it until the osprey drops the fish. So if an eagle has the bad judgment to fly over an osprey's airspace, which is the area around its nest, the osprey will give it all kinds of grief. And, yeah, they hate bald eagles because bald eagles are essentially lazy birds. They want to eat something that's been served up by someone else, like lasagna.
a questionable moral character.
Absolutely.
As Ben Franklin said. Now, we've only got about a minute and a half left, but I wanted you to tell us about, you know, how you're setting up all those cardinals for certain death in your backyard.
Yeah, well, you know,
what's wrong with you?
There's something really wrong with me. No, here's the deal. I have this sharp-shinned hawk pair nesting on my land, and that is cause for celebration for me because sharp-shinned hawks, unlike their larger cousins, the Cooper's hawk, are declining. Cooper's hawks are now the urban hawk in Ohio. They nest right in town over busy streets. The smaller sharp-shinned hawk, for reasons really unknown, is not doing well at all. So I host the sharp-shinned hawk. This is the third winter he's been with me, and I've seen him grow up from a streaky yellow-eyed immature into this exquisite ruby-eyed blue bullet. And I am actually launching a peon to him, a three-part blog peon to the beauty of this bird. I've been photographing him for 3 years, and I have a whole gallery of him that I'm posting about. But, so they nest on our land, and this guy preferentially kills male cardinals.
And you set them up by feeding them in your backyard
all
of that.
I'm like the crazy cat lady, you know, who like puts out the bird seed and lets her cat out. So go get them, Frisky. But I feel better about this because we have like 50 cardinals in our yard. We have too many cardinals, and that's because of me.
This is all natural, Julie. We've got to go.
Oh, poo.
I hope you'll come back again.
I would love to.
Okay. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. That was Julie Zickafoos on WOSU 820 NPR News.